When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Join us for a journey as we go back to the great civilizations of the past. Who were the people? What were they like? How did they begin? And how did they end? Let's find out on this episode of Fan of History. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Bernie. Soon we'll get to the 630s BC, but we have four subjects left that we want to talk about to give you this picture of what life was like in the Assyrian Empire.
And it's good stuff, so I think it's worth it.
Yes, it's important stuff as well. I'm going to talk about economy, trading, and hunting.
Nice.
And you will talk about something very different.
I'm going to talk about the intelligence services.
That will definitely be a separate episode, but so that will be coming up shortly. But we'll see how much I manage to talk about my three subjects.
Sounds good to me. So what's the first one? The economy, I think, right?
Yes. Remember that we have described the Assyrians from the very start as part warriors and part traders. Mm-hmm. They do love to trade, and they were forced to trade from the earliest times, from the very beginning, because the Assyrian heartland had no natural resources.
Right.
Except when they managed to find resources that became useful later, such as iron. But it's quite funny because today it's one of the world's greatest oil fields.
Right.
But they had no use for petroleum.
Right, that's so funny when you think about it.
So trading was a part of the Assyrians' life from the very beginning. Speaking of the economy, it is of course very different when the Assyrian Empire is small and when the empire is big. But there is a central heartland economy that is always there. Mm-hmm. And it's based on agriculture, animal husbandry, and trade. Mm-hmm. The southern border of the Assyrian heartland is interesting, close to the city of Asher, because that's also the southern limit of dependable annual rainfall.
Right.
So the Babylonian desert begins somewhat south of Asher.
Right.
And the Babylonian desert is more profitable than the Assyrian heartland, but it requires artificial irrigation. Mm-hmm. Which can be easily destroyed by the Assyrians.
Or the storm god.
Or anyone that doesn't like the inhabitants. But the Assyrian heartland is more robust, and it's easier to make your food there and be sure that you have your food when you need it.
Right. More of a Mediterranean climate. They're also located on the start of the rivers there, so that's another reason that I imagine they became traders.
It's also quite well located if you want to start an empire, because you can conquer stuff in all directions.
Exactly. That's a real good point.
But I think it is one of the reasons the Assyrians are so tough to deal with, because they live in this rather nice place which borders so many different regions. So everybody wanted their area, but they kept it for a very long time.
They did. Amazing that they did, in that, you know, a lot of countries that are located in areas that are don't have a lot of natural resources and natural defenses end up not lasting that long.
This, of course, also happened for this area many, many hundreds of years after the Assyrians are gone as well.
Of course.
Or the empire is gone, at least.
Of course. Yeah, good way to rephrase that. It's probably one of the reasons they were so militant. It kind of had to be.
So we have the main cereal they grow is barley. They have some wheat and some emmer. Is that the right pronunciation?
Yeah, I think that's emmer wheat, yeah. Kind of wheat.
So barley they use for bread. They grow sesame for oil and flax for linen.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they have beer.
Thank for God.
Wherever there's bread, there's beer.
That's true.
They also have vineyards, and they make wine. But the vineyards are located more in the mountains.
I don't think they were known for the best wine, or at least, you know, like most places, people want to get wine from far away. I do recall that the prized wine was from the Levant.
I can believe that. I would imagine that the Assyrians made, like, good enough wine.
Right.
Remember the story about the Celts invading Rome because somebody traded them Roman wine?
I didn't remember that.
It's when the Celts invade and sack Rome in 390 BC, one of the reasons were that, one of the legends is that the reason was that they got some wine and said, we want a lot more of this, let's invade them.
That's great.
We have orchards and gardens. From them we get a lot of fruit, nuts, leeks, onions, yeah. And cress. Do you know what cress is?
I think of like watercress as like sort of like a lettuce-y type of thing.
Oh, krasse in Swedish. Yeah, I know what it is. And of course, they use a lot of animals. Most of the animals were cattle, sheep, goats, donkeys, mules, and a lot of birds. For example, ducks. But if you remember the menu from the greatest party of all time, that included a lot of birds.
So they harvest, they like, what was the word I'm looking for? They domesticated them?
Oh, yes, they did. This is close to the area where domestication started many, many thousands of years before, and so they are master domesticators.
Gotcha.
They get a lot of eggs. They get milk from goats mainly, including butter and cheese. And, of course, they get wool from sheep.
Much everything we have, just a couple different, you know.
And for beasts of burden, you use mainly donkeys, mules, and maybe cattle, but not really horses, because all the horses are needed for war, yes.
Yeah, it's like you don't use a tank to plow a field.
Of course, you also get meat from the animals, but that is not that common.
Right, it's not like today where people just eat meat all the time.
No, meat is way too expensive.
Absolutely, they give it to the gods first.
There is a lot of shepherds with flocks, and they are working on a contract basis. So they get a fixed portion of the flock's yield and give the rest to the owner of the flock.
Gotcha. I read it. I saw a thing where, you know, we think of shepherds as like a meek little guy with this, but shepherds were actually like lumberjacks in the ancient day. Like really tough guys. They had to fight wolves and lions and keep their sheep from getting, you know.
And Arameans.
And Arameans, unless you were one.
In this period, at the end of the Neo-Assyrian Empire, the state is keeping a register of all animals, and you're taxed for them.
Oh.
I don't know how well it worked, but...
I mean, yeah, I know, right? I mean, like, how do you... If the sheep has more babies, and you hide one.
Yeah.
No sheep over there. We have them hit. Nope, still only have 8 sheep.
So then... We don't have money, as we have mentioned so many times. We are getting close to the invention of coins, but there are no coins yet. So wealth is mainly animals and land.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, land is like the paragon of wealth, the epitome of wealth. If you're a landowner, you're wealthy.
Right, even today.
But in theory, all land controlled by the Assyrian Empire belonged to Ashur.
Everything belongs to Ashur.
And of course, Ashur's representative, the king.
Convenient.
This is, of course, not what it was really like. So in practice, the state owned some land, but the remainder were held by wealthy families, temples, and private individuals.
Right.
There was also a special arrangement for land called the Ilku.
Ilku.
The Ilku. So then you don't own the land, but you can use the land in return for performing a service to the state.
Mm.
This is not only a military service. It could also be stuff they use their military for, like road building, repairing canals, and stuff like that.
Right. And you probably had to give some of the, you paid tax on the crops that you grew on your land.
Come again?
I said I would imagine you would pay tax on the crops that you used on the land too, right?
I think so, but I'm not entirely sure.
You'd have to pay, like you'd have to give them, if you're growing wheat, you give some percentage of your field, and if you're growing something else, you know.
Yes, I believe so. This Ilku thing is contested between scholars today. A few scholars believe that Ilku is not tied to land, but tied to actually being a citizen in Assyria.
Hmm.
So that you automatically, by being a citizen, you have to perform these services.
Probably a little bit of both.
Most scholars believe it's the land. It's probably a little bit of both.
Right. Over, you know, over generations, terms sort of change. But, you know, how you use it. It started as the land, and then if you don't even have land, they probably made you use it. You know, we're required to do service. I was doing some of my research for the next one we do. There's a lot of the people were very important. You could see, like, raids were meant to go and grab some people, and people wanted to escape. Like, say the Assyrians grabbed them or moved them. They wanted to escape back to where they went, and they didn't want them to go. It's almost kind of like, you know, the old communist things where they don't want them to leave because they needed them to do the work.
Yes, the moving of people is an integral part of the empire.
Right.
It is also possible that the Ilku were originally meant for land, but when the empire grew, they expanded it.
Yeah.
So as when the empire was big, you had a lot of people that didn't have to work on land, but perform other services for the empire, and those, the Ilku maybe was expanded to include them.
Yeah, that makes sense for sure.
So when trading, what did the Assyrians want?
Yeah, what did they want? There's no money.
They have all these animals and the food, and they have some stone they can build houses from. And of course, they have a bricks made from mud.
Mm-hmm.
What would they want?
Wine.
Oh, they have wine, but maybe better wine. Yes. That's one of the imports, better wine.
What else?
We talked so much about one of their imports.
Horses.
Yes, horses. Also, camels.
Oh, yeah. Remember when Ashurbanipal got all the camels, and there were so many camels that people were using a camel for... They'd use a camel to buy a beer.
Yes. They also wanted metals.
Like tin, probably, and copper.
And now I'm starting to wonder where the iron come from, because I know they have more iron than most people.
Yeah, well... It's also the trees when it comes to iron, because they were butted up against the mountains there, Urartu, so trees were very important. So you need to make charcoal the iron,
they need to burn
a lot of trees. Yeah, but they wanted to control. So that's the thing, they wanted to control all these trade routes, right?
Yeah, I think the best timber came from Syria.
Yes, and in Elam and up in Urartu, yes. And Syria had a lot, they had the good timber too, but it was a little farther away in the beginning of the empire.
Mm. They also imported precious stones, ivory, of course,
mm-hmm.
aromatics, like perfume.
That's been forever. I mean, that's how the New World got found, right?
Oh, yeah.
We're looking for that stuff.
One very controversial import that the scholars cannot agree on is that possibly... They imported silk from China.
Really?
There were a lot of middlemen on the Silk Road, but the Silk Road was a thing.
I would definitely think that they've seen silk, you know, how popular it was and how easy it was to get. But I'm sure you're right. They've definitely had some silk.
Even if they had not seen silk, imagine some trader from the Afghanistan area or something reaching this place with silk. They would get a lot for it.
Oh, for sure. That's how it would get. That's how it got there. Eventually, it made its way to Rome in the Roman days. But for sure, I would definitely think the Assyrians had some silk. Even if there's no evidence, like, you know, archaeological of it, I'm sure they had some.
So what do you think they exported to get all this stuff?
They just went and took it. I think they exported some of their agricultural products, I would think.
They mostly needed the agricultural products to feed all the Assyrians. They were not Babylonia or Egypt. They didn't have an excess of food.
All right, let me take another stab at it then. How about iron?
They wanted iron for themselves.
Bastards. All right, I get three guesses.
Yes. This one is hard.
I'm sitting here in my fish coat, so I'll say fish.
They did not export fish. They were actually quite good craftsmen, so they manufactured stuff. Mostly textiles.
They're British. That's the core of capitalism. You bring in the resources from outside the periphery of empire, manufacture the goods, and sell them to the people outside. That is the epitome of capitalism.
They were also pretty good at exporting what they imported. So they were traders, and they were located at this fantastic crossroad for the trade routes. Mm-hmm. So they took their tolls, they bought something cheap and sold it expensive.
Yeah.
So you have to go through Assyria pretty much to reach Babylonia if you come from the north. And
absolutely.
You could also reach the Persian Gulf or the Mediterranean through Assyria.
That's right. And then they were sort of on the top there. They were able, kind of like a puppet master almost. If you see, you know, they could control this, the rivers here, and then they controlled the Levant and then they even finally controlled Egypt for a little bit.
And we know that the Assyrians loved to document stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Almost as much as the Babylonians. But there is a lack of cuneiform documentation for trade. And we believe that the reason is that a lot of this trade was outsourced to Arameans, Phoenicians, and Arabs, and others.
Hmm. That makes sense.
That they weren't very good at writing in cuneiform.
Right, and they would have been on paper anyway, so we'd have lost it.
Yes. So there was a lot of profit coming into the Assyrian state from taxes and tolls on all foreign traders as well.
Yeah.
I just mentioned that they were good craftsmen, but they were not craftsmen in the medieval sense.
So right.
Crafts were centralized to palaces, temples, and large estates.
That's where they manufactured them, you mean?
Yes.
So there wasn't like little cottage industries?
No, it was very centralized by the state. And the crown controlled the raw materials, sent the raw materials to the craftsmen. Thus, it was good to have them in the palace. And then the craftsmen delivered the finished products. And they got food and housing from the state.
Now that's the opposite of capitalism.
Oh, it sounds like the Soviet Union.
Exactly. But it's definitely you want to be the manufacturer. I mean, that's how the British, right? They were the shopkeeper. They called them the shopkeeper of the world when they had their empire. They made textiles and then they traded, like you said.
But this system with like craftsmen collectives, that broke down when the empire grew large. So they changed it and implemented a craftsman contract where you could repay the crown for the raw materials in other ways.
Hmm.
And this scaled a lot better.
You know, I mean, they were just inventing all this stuff. You know, it's really the first time I could say this. They really run it like a business.
They do, and they're very businesslike compared to other peoples.
Absolutely.
Yes, look at the Greeks going around thinking about philosophy and statecraft, whereas the Assyrians are just war and trade.
Exactly. And like, you know, I mean, I feel like the reasoning was to keep chaos away, you know, just stability, conservative, like you say.
But even in the largest empire, all the wealth is in the heartland. Mm-hmm. Because the provinces and the tributary states, they are taxed, money's flowing from them to the Assyrian heartland.
Right.
And we know about the tributes paid annually. You have to come to the Assyrian king and parade in front of him with all the stuff you're going to give him.
Amazing.
And if you don't show up for your annual tribute, we know what happens.
Yeah, you get never seen or heard from again. When we talk about the intelligence, you'll find out that act of bringing the tribute was also part of intelligence gathering. That's one of the reasons they had to come. They had to come and check on the health of the king. Bring your tribute. You know, show your face, kind of be like, what's going on in your little place over there? And that wasn't always the king. It could be their, you know, emissaries. But they had to do your regular tribute and give them your information.
And they also had to renew their treaty oaths.
Yep. And if they didn't, they would drink donkey urine.
And, of course, when the empire was large, people were complaining, like, why do I have to bring this cow from the pyramids to Nineveh? And this was sold with local collection centers in the provinces.
Oh. All right.
All the tributes went directly to the crown.
Right.
And then the crown distributed the wealth. A good way to keep control.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah. And it probably depends. Yeah. So if it was an actual imperial province, right, they would bring a vassal could bring it to to his imperial province, and then they would, the governors would get it to the king.
Yes.
They'd have to go check on the health of the king, too.
Yes.
And give their intelligence reports and give the money.
And their oaths.
Very mafia-like, you know?
Very mafia-like. Well, a lot of valuable stuff was stolen on raids and campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
It all became the property of the crown.
Mm-hmm.
But then the crown rewarded people who were successful in the campaign. And of course, temples and provincial governors and spread out the wealth to make everyone happy.
But you couldn't just take it yourself during the battle, during the raids. You had to.
I'm sure you could take like small stuff, but if you tried to steal gold or valuable jewelry or something, then things will not end well for you.
Yeah, you know what? It reminds me of the Book of Joshua, because the Book of Joshua just so reminds me of Assyrian campaigns. Totally, like they ripped off of them. And remember, if you remember the one part, one of the guys takes too much stuff. He takes stuff and it was supposed to be for the Lord. Like when you pillage the Canaanites, you got to give it to the Lord. And he didn't. So they found out who it was and they stoned him to death. And I would imagine it was sort of a similar throughout the whole Near East at the time, you know?
Yeah.
You give it to your Lord, which is your king.
Regarding the temples, they were pretty much self-sufficient in the small Assyrian empire. But in the large empire, the temples couldn't keep up and were dependent on crown support as well.
Mm-hmm. And if you didn't support them, the crown didn't support them, they were a hotbed of insurgency.
That particular temple was in a pretty bad spot. But we know that some Assyrian kings did demote certain temples and upgraded others.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at the Assyrian deal. So we're actually going to do a business deal and you have no coin.
Okay.
So it's not barter in the sense that I'm giving you 5 cows for 23 sheep. Although I'm sure that happened. But as soon as the empire started to grow, there were standards of exchange. Mm. So the most common.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
One thing traded were copper, but in the 7th century they had moved very much to silver. But copper and silver were like ingots and certain weights of copper and silver.
So it's kind of like proto-money when you think about it.
Yes, they really need coins, but they did not invent them.
Right, it's like, but it's, you know, it's, you have to weigh it basically. A coin is basically supposed to be weighed already.
And we note that in these exchanges that we have documented, there is often no metal involved, but they still value their items in silver or copper, and then the other part values their items in silver and copper, and then you reach an agreement. But there's no actual metal changing hands.
That's like money.
Oh yes, and things were not like that in Babylonia. There you actually exchange metal.
Yeah, because that's actually like fiat money, because there's no actual metal, but they're just saying this is what it would be, and then that's kind of what money is, what you agree it is.
We know this because we see in the Babylonian records that there are comments on the quality and form of the metal. So like, this were copper, but it was kind of dirty, and I think there's something else in it. This is rather bad.
Yeah, like that complaint letter even, that was even older than that. I remember that episode you did.
Oh, yes. So then you needed some way to measure the silver or copper. So you had to have standard weights and measures.
Right.
And we have talked about this a little. Maybe you remember the mina.
No, the mina.
Yeah, the royal mina is the standard of exchange. And then you have mina, a local mina as well. You can have a mina of Carchemish, for example.
Oh, no, that's the first I heard it.
Oh, and that's a standard weight.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So then
that's
the
money
state,
too.
Yes, the state provided official weights.
Right, so that's like money.
No, they were like a weight that you could weigh your metal against.
Oh, so yeah, I know, I get it. I mean, yes. It, but that by them doing that, they're saying, okay, this is officially, because a weight is only a, you know, you make it up. I could say it's a pound. You could say it's a kilogram, right? It's whatever I say it is. I mean, it's obviously it weighs what it weighs, but what I call that weight. You know what I mean? Sort of proto money by the state saying, if this weighs this and then that's this much silver, then.
And of course, this is a very exploitable system. So you had to know in some way that this was an official weight sanctioned by the crown. So now I'm going to tell you what you should look for if somebody is trying to weigh something. So you have to, they have to have an official weight. You know it's an official weight sanctioned by the king himself if it is in the shape of a duck or a lion. So you were like, my silver is equal in weight to these ducks or lions. There's also a cuneiform label on the weight telling you which king is sanctioning it. So it could be an old weight. And what it actually weighs.
That's pretty cool. I would love to see one of those. I got to go find something like that in a museum.
I think they should be available somewhere because we have these.
Oh, sure. I'm sure I can find it online.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
That's we cool. have a lot of documentation of these business transactions. Even though we have lost a lot, there are still some.
Yeah.
They have been found mainly in palaces. So maybe we have lost the transactions that were made in other places.
Yeah, right. They're in somebody's house and they're, you know, they must have had some kind of offices, right? Some of these people?
Oh, yes. Probably in the palace or in the provincial.
Yeah, so if you're in the provincial palace and you were a trader, I guess you set up business office in that area.
Things we found are credit lists, inventories, people keeping accounts, tax assessments. That is like, how much am I actually going to pay in tax for all this?
Yeah.
Census lists, of course, you have to know your people. And a lot of different notes and memos concerning trade.
Very organized.
The Assyrian state never tried to fix or control prices.
Hmm.
It was a strict supply and demand.
Hmm.
That is somewhat significant because we have a lot of attempts to fix and control prices in other nations before, or in ancient times.
Of course. And then here's these people who would try to control every other thing.
And that was the reason the price of camels could plummet.
I was thinking the same exact thing. They were, that's interesting. Some economists should do like a deep dive. It's interesting.
It's also noteworthy that very few documents detail the standard of living. So people don't brag about how they live, in a sense. Thus, we don't really know what the standard of living was. But surely it must have fluctuated with the success of the empire.
Right. And it depends. In some from archaeology, you could tell if the bigger, you know, what a bigger house, but they probably didn't want to write too much about it. Just like today, you know, when you get to fly too close to the sun, you get your wings clipped. I don't think you'd want the Assyrian king to think you were doing any better than he was.
we see clearly, though, that the outlying areas are much poorer than the heartland.
Mm. Plus, they're taking all the stuff from them.
And this concentration of wealth in the heartland, of course, provides great strength and authority for the crown.
Mm-hmm.
And also, possibly, it made rebellions much more difficult.
Yeah. Really, another aspect of why it's the first true empire. That's what an empire also does, you know? I mean, I know Sargon and down in Sumer had a sort of empire, but it wasn't as big and it didn't last as long.
There is, of course, an upper limit for the heartland. Like, how much food can you provide? How many people can live in the heartland?
Mm-hmm.
But we have few but some evidence of inflation, of an overall inflation, with the devaluation of silver by the time of Ashurbanipal because of his success when he was successful.
Yeah. Right, like the camel story.
But this process of keeping the outlying areas poor also perhaps prevented further expansion.
Yeah, I mean, we do see the democratic societies actually worked out a lot better.
I see a clear difference to the Roman Empire at its height because the Roman Empire worked to move power into the provinces by the after Augustus.
Yeah, well, maybe they started figuring that out.
Yes, you couldn't govern the whole. The Roman Republic had the problem that you actually had to physically be in Rome to govern it.
Right.
And here is a somewhat similar situation that once the empire becomes huge, it takes a lot of time to get something done in an outlying area.
I would imagine.
And of course, we have the Iron Fist. All the violence from the Assyrian state. When you don't pay your tribute, you get visited by the royal army.
Right.
And very few softer techniques to manage outlying areas.
I have to say, from more and more research, they just weren't that loved.
And I think this is the greatest flaw in their economy, because the outlying areas, the provinces, they're all there just to supply the heartland. Mm-hmm. And eventually you will piss everyone off. And that will lead to the downfall of the empire. Spoiler.
Yeah, well, it's every empire. It's every empire they do. They suck it in from the outside and then they... Well...
Well, I think the Romans were onto something in the 2nd century AD, when they had an extremely stable state. And it kind of worked, but then there were plagues and wars and stuff.
Yeah. And then they try to control...
Bad emperors.
Mm-hmm. Emperors don't... They have to have good emperors for a while. That's impossible. You always get a bad one. Oh, goddamn Commodus.
Yeah, that's what Commodus I was thinking.
Yeah. Commodus. Now every president of the United States is the next Commodus. That's always the... Obama was the next Commodus. Trump is the next Commodus. So probably Biden, he's Commodus.
Now I want to talk about Commodus, but that's not what we are going to talk about here.
No.
But I love the way he wanted to... He learned that Julius Caesar had changed the name of July to his name.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Augustus did the same thing. And Commodus then, many years later, was like, okay, I am greater than all of them. Let's change the name of all the months to Commodus. But I said, won't there be a problem with this? No, let's change it all. And by the way, let's change the name of all cities to Commodus as well. In the month of Commodus, I went to Commodus.
I wonder if there was a recent American president who would do that if he could.
I can't think of one.
I can't either.
Jimmy Carter.
But yeah, he was such a narcissist.
I wanted to speak a little about the hunt.
Oh, yeah.
I think I've already blamed the Assyrians for exterminating the Mesopotamian lion.
Yeah, I think you have.
And we know that they really like to depict themselves hunting lions.
Mm-hmm.
We saw Ashurnasirpal II strangle a lion with his one hand.
Yeah, that's pretty tough.
And of course, they wouldn't lie about that, would they?
No, I mean, anybody could. I mean, an Assyrian king is obviously able to strangle a lion with one hand, probably his left hand.
If we look at, I made a video for the YouTube channel about Tiglath-Pileser I, who was before our time, before 1000 BC,
mm-hmm.
who talked about hunting dolphins.
No, I gotta look at that.
But it is a common factor among warlike peoples in history that they do like hunting. Hunting is like war in peacetime.
Yeah.
And the Assyrians were no better. They hunted animals and killed them for sport already in the Middle Assyrian Empire, and probably even before that.
For sure. I mean, that's been a human thing, though. I mean, in Catahoulic, they had bullhorns on their walls, you know, like we have antlers on our walls around, you know.
This makes me wonder if the Assyrians hadn't gone into this last great imperial phase, the Neo-Assyrian Empire, maybe they could have lasted much longer, because it seems like they are exploding, in a sense, at the very end of their 1,000 years or more.
That's a really good point.
It actually happens to the hunts. The royal hunt becomes a national institution. And it has many similarities to the annual campaign.
Yeah.
So now is the time to go to war. Now is the time to go hunting with the king.
Yeah.
And of course, the greatest prize is lions.
Yeah.
You were forbidden to kill a lion.
Really?
Unless you had the approval of the king. Or unless you really had to kill the lion. But the king was very upset. He was the only one with the right to kill lions.
You'd have to ask, I guess, if there's lions terrorizing your province or something.
I guess people were helping the king hunt lions, but he just said he killed them all.
Right. So how would I know we have a lot of reliefs of the hunt, right? I know even Ashurbanipal liked to do the hunt.
Of course he did. And the hunt was somewhat religious as well. You ended it with a religious ceremony, the royal annual hunt. Especially for the gods Ninurta and Palil. They were the hunting deities.
And they would do it out of a chariot, right? So he would get on his chariot and they would get the lion and they would...
And then, of course, everybody could see him better as well.
Right.
But you can find lions all the time. And then when you don't find lions, it was the habit of the Assyrian king to hunt anything that moved. Except humans. You didn't hunt humans for sport.
Thankfully.
But we know that the Assyrian... the dolphins are a good example. But the Assyrian kings killed fish, birds, and of course, any mammal they could find. But they were most honored in the lion and of course, the elephant. Because elephants are big.
Would they bring them in and hunt the elephants? I know they would bring the lions in later on when they, you know, they would bring them somewhere. They would have sort of a closed area, right? And they would get the chariot and then they would hunt the lion. I wonder, elephants, wow.
Possible. Imagine if you were an up-and-coming Assyrian noble and you could get an elephant for the royal hunt, you would probably do that.
Ah, I gotcha. Interesting.
So there were people capturing animals and bringing them to Assyria for the purposes of the royal hunt.
Oh,
so you
cool.
got paid for animals that the king could hunt. I wonder if the king was informed. Oh, by some chance, there's a lion right outside our door.
You better go get him. You said you were a good hunter. It was like the ancient Ace Ventura, you know, Ace Ventura. You ever see that movie, Ace Ventura, with Jim Carrey? It was with the animals.
Oh, yes.
You know, he had to go capture this ancient crazy guy would capture all these crazy animals and bring them to the king of Assyria. I guess it's like an ancient bullfight, but with lions and...
But imagine this situation. You are the Assyrian king, and you have planned for an evening in the harem with your 8 favorite wives. And then some idiot shows up telling you, oh, by a chance, there's a lion right outside. What do you do?
Well, if you're so virile like him and you could have 8 wives just for the night, you'd probably go out and kill them with your bare hands and then you go in, make love to all your wives.
No, what they did was like, okay, capture the lion and then we'll hunt it later. Which led to zoological gardens and the study of wild animals.
Nice.
And remember, there is one animal in particular that they are not prone to killing.
Horses.
Monkeys.
Oh, that was nice of them.
Yes. So monkeys were kept as pets. And there was these zoological gardens. You could display the wild animals to the people.
I mean, that's probably is the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, too, that they thought of, you know. The Assyrians, we've discussed this before, but... If there was one in Babylon, there was one in Assyria, too. And I think I've said this before, too. Those gardens, that's sort of like the Garden of Eden was like that. You walk in your garden with your king and your lord.
Very Assyrian.
Very cool that there was monkeys in them, though.
They did manage to exterminate elephants from the area as well.
Yeah. I wonder what the cages were like. Like, you know, like we think of cages that we see... You know, and these, I guess they would just be brick, big brick walls. Yeah, that would keep the animals in.
Or perhaps wood.
Yeah. Yeah, you would think, interesting. That would be cool.
We only have information about the royal hunts, but we assume that most Assyrian males hunted for sport. But of course, they kept clear of the lions and the elephants.
Yeah, yeah. There was probably deer and things like that. Was there deer? What kind of like?
I would expect they were there.
Yeah.
We also know that, of course, the chariot was the most popular way of hunting for the king. But we also have depictions of the king stalking animals, ambushing animals. And there seems to be a, how do you say this in English, hunting party stampeding against the animals, driving the animals towards the king.
Oh, yeah, driving them, yeah.
Who was probably in a chariot, ready with his bow and arrow.
Yeah, yeah. How about boars? Do we ever have anything about them hunting wild boars?
There were boars. Also a wild bull.
Oh.
They didn't last long.
No. No, but still, that's pretty late for there to be wild bull, 600 BC, you know?
Yes, but there were bison in America much longer. They didn't have Ashurnasirpal II.
Yeah, they sort of had a different culture. They sort of kept, you know, they didn't also clear cut the forest of Syria.
That's about all I had today. So let's move on to the intelligence service.
Yeah, we're going to do that next time, right? All right. So I wanted to say that lately I've been getting some more messages from our listeners, and I like that. I'm kind of flattered. Sometimes I wonder if anybody's listening, right? But then when you hear messages, I mean, I know they are. We see them. But when you get some messages and they're positive, I appreciate it. And if you have any suggestions or questions, if I messed anything up, please, you know, message me on Facebook, on the page. I've been trying to keep the page. I just share interesting history articles, and I try to keep them in our time frame and stuff that interests me, because I am interested in the prehistory. So
I have left Facebook myself, but if you want to reach me in particular, you can always send a message to Bernie, or my assistant is also looking at the Fan of History Facebook.
Yes. And then Dan will tell you about our Patreon page.
Yes, we do. We do need some money to keep going, and you can help us by becoming a patron at Patreon. Search for Fan of History, and then you make a contribution per episode. It's a mutual agreement, so if we don't make episodes, you don't pay anything. However, money is drawn the month after the episode was published, so some people think that money is charged even though we made an episode, but it's for last month's episode.
Yes, that's to make sure it's been published and not taken down and canceled for any reason because we said something bad.
We do have 16 patrons right now, and we are very thankful for that, but we do need a couple more.
That will be awesome. I would love to get this program called The Script for editing, and it could take every time I say or you know, and I could find every single one and take them out.
That would be useful.
It would be, but it's like a monthly subscription.
Okay, let's talk intelligence services next time.
Yeah. All right, next time we'll talk to you then.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Dan. Cheers.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon, patreon.com/fanofhistory. Just $1 an episode would help us out. Thanks, and see you next time.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.